We're starting in 5, 4, 3, 2. I was at last night. I hadn't been on stage for, and we're going to talk about you by talking about me first. I hadn't been on stage for a couple of months, really. Maybe a little bit. Yeah, I showed up with Dana Carvey, and I'd really been concentrating on this podcast stuff. But we started talking with the owner of the club. It's CB Live here, also owned same owners as Stand Up Live and the Tempe Improv. And it's Joel Bachkoff.
My first manager.
Yes, and he had just great things to say about you, and I made him fix those.
I corrected all of them.
I couldn't think of the word corrected. Thank you for helping me with vocabulary issues. I really couldn't. So he started talking about little bits about you, how you worked with him. You were in Florida. And I didn't realize how many different places you had been, because I think of you from what you usually talk about. First of all, I knew you from Denver, because of the Daily Blast Live. So I knew you from that and the Bob and Tom show, which I assumed you were just an LA comic first, because I'm not up to date. And that's part of what the podcast is helping me with, is just re-associate myself with the world. I feel like
we should call this Welcome Back, Frank.
Welcome Back, Franker. So he started talking about some things. And like I said, I thought of you from being from LA, Denver, then you've talked mostly about Cleveland. So I started thinking in terms of that's who you are. You're the Cleveland guy. And then it's just how we label people internally. It's nothing on purpose, but it's just that's what I said. But then he started talking about how you came up in Miami and you were a school teacher. Is that?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So school teacher. And you had been talking about going to school for pre-med on a previous podcast.
Yes, sir.
What have you not done?
I don't know. It was a weird journey. I'm born and raised in Cleveland. I was there till I was 17.
Okay, so that's real.
That's real.
Okay.
I know when you put things out the way you just did, it sounds like I just got caught in a huge lie.
Well, I do. I feel like you'll catch me if you can't.
Yeah. No, it's weird when you look at your life, like in the rearview mirror, and you're like, wow, that all happened. Yeah. I grew up in Cleveland until I was 17. And then, I went to college in Mississippi at a small black school. I'm sure you're very familiar, Frank, with, traditionally black colleges.
I attended one.
I wish you would. It would be amazing.
You know what? That would be culturally interesting, and I think I'd learn a lot.
There are white people that go to all black schools.
Are there really?
Oh yeah.
So they're not technically all black schools. They're mostly black schools.
99.1%. Yeah.
What black. What makes? And I don't want to make this sound like a negative connotation, but what? Why does a white person go to an all black school?
They might have the program that they want to.
Okay.
You know, or.
No,
you know.
I really want to understand.
That's a great question.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a question most people would say. Why, what makes a person want to go there? But the education, that's pretty simple, right? I mean, I don't even think, I've never even thought about that. I've thought about Morehouse is a mostly black school, an all black school. It's, I almost feel dirty saying all black school, like it's a bad thing or something. Like it's like separate but equal kind of a thing. Maybe it's just my white guilt. I don't know.
I think so. I think we need to take you to a black college football game.
Right. I didn't even know I had white guilt until I met you. Not true at all. I have none. So, okay. So you are, continue. I tend to interrupt.
Oh, no, it's all good. So I went to school in Mississippi in the deep South. The name of my school is called Tougaloo, Frank.
All right.
Can you say Tougaloo?
Tougaloo.
There you go.
What takes you from Cleveland to Tougaloo?
A lot of my family is from Mississippi, and a lot of my family went to Tougaloo. It's kind of like a familiar thing.
Okay.
So
that's the name of the school is Tougaloo?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know if that was
I know it sounds like I cursed at you in another language.
I thought it's like goodbye, Tougaloo.
Really?
That was white, wasn't it? Was
no, funny. It's good. No, it's. I always said it sounded like what you yell at the end of a card game. Like when you throw your last card out and you just go, Tougaloo, pay me.
I love that.
Yeah.
So you go down south because you have family there and family have gone to Tougaloo?
Yes. And I was definitely, you know, the kind of person leaving high school. I needed some kind of structure kind of set up. I'm actually surprised looking back and I went as far away from home as I did. I just, because I hadn't really been anywhere and I didn't really have any aspirations to do anything in college. I was kind of like a, I think there are a lot of people like this, Frank. I didn't know what the hell was going on until I was like 26. I was just like in a fog, you know, just like going wherever the wind blew me. So, you know, I'll go down to Tougaloo, meet some good friends, establish myself in school. I ended up
getting. You did know people when you went there.
Yeah. I knew people, but like, you know, I had family there, but, you know, I would see them, you know, on like Sundays, we'd have, you know, brunch or breakfast or dinner, but you know, it really just kind of gave me a little bit of accountability. And the good thing with me is I didn't drink or anything in college, which I saw really take a lot of my friends down. I was so behind academically that I felt like I couldn't even do any of that stuff.
Behind academically because of the schools where you came from?
No, because I didn't crack a book in high school, Frank.
Okay, but you're a highly intelligent person. I that's one of the things that struck me when I would first talk to you and listen to you on the radio. The angles you take at things are not the typical way people go at things. You don't go for a lot of jokes that most people, I think, would go for. And that was what was really interesting to me. So the fact that you were a smart kid, probably, yes?
Yeah, I think so. But I just was not. I was not into school at all, especially in high school.
Kind of grades did you get in high school?
B's, C's, and some sprinkled in a couple D's.
Really?
Yeah, I was middle to below the pack. Definitely, I didn't do anything, and I wasn't even. The thing is, some kids don't do anything because they're smoking pot behind the school or they're messing around with girls or they're skateboarding or whatever. First of all, how old do I sound? But, you know, like I just didn't do anything. I didn't have any, I played a lot of pickup basketball, but I just didn't have any desire to do anything. I was like a nihilist almost. But I didn't know it. I just was like I said, I was just kind of walking around in this fog. Like I didn't see real life was coming. And quite frankly, I mean, Tougaloo was one of the only schools I got into. So I went down there, studied hard for a couple years, ended up getting a scholarship to go to Brown. So I went to Brown in Rhode Island. I did my last 2 years there.
When you're at Tougaloo, you discover more of what direction you think you want to go in terms of education?
I had an amazing roommate who changed my life. I mean, just the people throw the word genius around to the point where it doesn't mean anything anymore. But he really was a real life genius. Like you only see a couple of them in your lifetime. He was on that level. He's a gifted guy. He's a physician now. But yeah, he kind of showed me that you can get good grades and work hard and still, because I remember still being so immature in college. I thought getting good grades meant like you were there's somehow nerdy or so. It's the idiocy of it. Just it's hard.
Doesn't make sense. You look back and
you're like, I can't believe. Yeah. So
you're at Tougaloo and you decide you want to, what do you think your career path is at that point that you're going to go to Brown and study
biology?
Okay.
So I came in as a biology major. Just because I don't know. I didn't have a plan. I was like, hey, I like biology.
I like bodies.
Breathing's cool. So yeah, I did that. So I went to Brown, still studying biology.
I like that you just say that. So I went to Brown. That's not an easy thing to do.
it's the way that whole thing transpired was just it. Not only it was crazy, but it was life changing because you talked about your friend Brian Love that we're gonna have on another episode. Me going to Brown and seeing how Ivy League students study, how they prepare, but also how they partied,
right.
Changed my life and like the things they've done.
It's that whole work hard and envelop yourself completely into something, delve completely into it, be the work, the study, and then when you're done with that, after you've taken the test, just go crazy.
Exactly.
It's I don't know if that's healthy, but that seems to be what the smartest, most hardworking people do, is they have crazy drive and they party hard, like they work hard, but it's that, it seems to be almost like bipolar, where you just work so hard and you're all into work and then you need this crazy release. But it also seems to work and seems to be how a lot of some of the top people in this country, at least, thrive and survive and become something special.
Well, who was it? Was it Spielberg? They said they used to... Who directed Jaws?
Spielberg.
Was that with Spielberg? Yeah, it's just like they said that after certain productions, he'll just go and just kind of check out for a little while, like go, you know, to a hotel and just like not associate with anybody because he's so stressed out from, I guess, the shoot. I don't know if it's him or another director, but it just, he puts everything he's got into it. And the day after they wrap, he literally just gets in the car and goes detaches from life. So I don't know. I mean, maybe that's what they're doing. For me personally, it just like, that was the first time like I had seen kids that went to boarding schools.
Right.
That, you know, literally were away from home for 6 months during high school, you know, and they went to, you know, Georgetown Prep, and, you know, they graduated in classes of 11 kids and stuff like that. It was shocking to me. And it just showed me all the possibilities that life could have for you. And, you know, I think from there, that kind of changed my perspective in that. I felt like if they could do it, then I could do it, as corny as that sounded.
Right. No, that's, I have a friend, Ed Washington, who believes that, and I don't 100% believe this, because I believe there's opportunity involved in certain things, and he believes you can make the opportunity. And I said, I'm 5'6". There's no way with my fast twitch muscle, which I wouldn't even describe it as that, my average to below average speed twitch muscle, could make it to the NBA or NFL or Major League Baseball. It just wasn't going, or even hockey. I just wasn't going to be able to do that. I don't believe. He's like, well, if you work hard enough, you can get anything. And I'm like, I think you're crazy. And what's the name of the book? Outliers, which
10,000 hours.
10,000 hours. And but it also, then there's other chapters that people seem to look over that are about opportunity. The fact that Bill Gates had an opportunity being living in Washington, he just so happened to grow up near Washington at the right time, and be the right age to go on this computer that only the University of Washington had. I think that's all.
Right. He had access to a computer 20 years before anybody else did.
Right. And he could go write code and constantly and get those hours. Most people didn't have that opportunity. So you're at Brown, studying biology.
Studying biology. I got my degree in bio, and I stayed in Rhode Island, and I did medical research at Rhode Island Hospital with this guy named Dr. Lauren Fast. We ended up presenting our findings at the IBM conference. I remember in Palisades, New Jersey, and what we were doing. Like, I did that. We presented our research, which was basically trying to prevent tissue rejection. So for example, if I gave you a kidney, there's a good chance that your body would just reject it because it would see it as a foreign foreign body, and your body would attack it. So what we were
hold
trying
on,
to do,
hold on, you're giving me such a quick opportunity to go, you mean my body would build a wall? Okay, so
literally,
hey, when you have these powers, these impression powers, you gotta do it. So the by the way, I want to throw this in before you go on to just the sentence, we presented our research. I haven't said that ever. I think that's a pretty cool statement to have been able to have said. Continue.
So we were trying to figure out how to mask you know, any kind of tissue donation coming into your body, and not allow it to be perceived as a foreign body and therefore attacked by your white blood cells. So we were working on that for a couple of years, and I just the pay working under a grant just isn't much. So I decided to apply to graduate school. I got into graduate school in Miami at a school called Barry University in Miami. So
what
I left.
Age, what age are you at? You how old are you at that point?
Maybe 25, 24.
Just wondering about the age. Okay.
Yeah.
So at that point, you can rent a car without having to pay extra.
Yes.
Okay. I could
that's how you go about
that's
it.
How I go by.
That's how you determine everybody's age. So you can rent a car.
I remember so many of those things as I was just starting stand-up comedy. Okay. So did you get your degree? Do you get your degree at Brown?
I got a degree. Yeah, I got my bio degree from Brown.
So you did get your bio degree, and then you went to, that's right, because then you went to graduate school at Barry?
At Barry University, yes.
So from Tougaloo to Brown to Barry.
That's it.
Okay.
That sounds weird when you say it like
starting
that.
It's starting to sound like a Key and Peele football sketch.
So I'm at Barry, and I'm studying biomedical sciences. And I'm down there for, because I remember I moved, I got to Miami September 10th, 2001, maybe it's September 1st, 2001, because when 9/11 happened, I didn't have any cable yet because they hadn't even put my cable in. And I remember waking up on my air mattress and seeing 9/11 happening. And I was so like out of it. I just turned my TV off and went to school that day. Huh. And then went to that. And I was like, why is the library closed on a Tuesday? And I'm like, is it Martin Luther King Day? Like, I feel like I was the last person to realize. And I remember I went to a fast food place in Miami called Pollo Loco. And there were people crying in the fast food place. I was like, what the hell is going on? I remember thinking that.
I love that you thought on Tuesday, what is it, Martin Luther King Jr. Day?
It was just like, so I was like, there. It must be a holiday I don't know about.
I know, I got it, but that was just interesting that that's where you went to.
on a Tuesday.
I guess it makes some sense. I mean, I'm trying to think what I would think. I don't know if I would think that. I think the first thing I would think is, maybe Veterans Day or something. I don't know if there's a cultural thing that this is just something that was interesting to me. But it's just it just hit me there. So you're at Barry, and then what happens? What do you?
I knocked those 2 years out.
Get your master's.
Get my master's in biomedical sciences, and instead of applying to medical school, I had a friend of mine who had done my master's program a year before, and she was teaching middle school. She was like, hey, we need another middle school teacher at our school because I guess their science teacher had been placed on like super early bed rest because she was having, what do you call, like a traumatic pregnancy or whatever, a difficult pregnancy. So she was on bed rest like 5 months into her pregnancy. So they needed a science teacher. So when I got done at Barry, before I knew it, I was teaching seventh grade science, like almost with no plan. It was just like within 2 weeks, I was just like, well, I guess I'm doing this.
So you're teaching, and how much do you have in student loans at that point for medical?
Oh, Lord have mercy. I mean, I think I might have got a 6 month deferment or something because I was working under a grant. But they were, I mean,
astronomical.
Yeah, 60,000, 80,000, something like that. Not so good.
So at that point, 2 to 3 years worth of working at the middle school.
I was at the middle school for 4.5 years because technically I started.
No, I meant that's how long it would take. That's how many the salary from 2 to 3 years working at the middle school to
without pay. Eating or clothing myself, just sending all my money to Sally Mae. It would I mean, I'd love to talk about student loans another day and just
Let's get.
I don't know. I have some thoughts, Frank. Yeah. But yeah, so started teaching middle school. And I taught for 4.5 years, and I would say maybe halfway through my first full year, I kind of started going to bars and looking at open mics, not doing them. I was just looking, and one day I signed up. And
do you think the teaching and presenting your research? Do you think the teaching got you into speaking in front of people, or had you done that before?
No, I had never spoken in front of people. So I think the teaching, everything, it was everything in terms of me becoming a stand-up, because you get used to you being the only voice in the room. You get used to having all eyeballs on you, and there's a comfort in that. So I didn't have that kind of, oh my God, everybody's looking at me. It's like they should be, because I was so used to it, you know, for 6 periods a day, having people staring at me. So I think the teaching helped, and obviously it gave me this chunk of material that I was starting with that was kind of unique from other comics. And
were you teaching a particular class in middle school?
I was teaching, it was 7th grade science, just kind of general science. So you do the planets, you know, a little bit of soil, a little biology, a little chemistry, the periodic table, some physics, you know, photosynthesis. You just kind of cover all those general topics. And then
what's the makeup of this school? Is it well-to-do kids? Is it all over the board?
It was kind of all over the board because of where it was located.
Public school
in Miami. And it was right on the border of Miami and Fort Lauderdale, like literally on the border. And, the neighborhoods that poured into it were, Black and Hispanic working class, upper and very upper class white and Hispanic, and then just working poor, and they all kind of were at the same school, just because of where it was located. It kind of pulled from three distinctly different neighborhoods, so you had just different types of kids, different gradients of kids. But yeah, it's in a huge school too, like 2700 kids, 2500. So big school. I taught 6 periods a day, probably 36 kids on average per class. And dude, teaching changed my life. Changed my life.
Sorry, just had to take care of something. So you go, you start teaching, you start looking at the open mics.
Yeah, I stick my head into a couple open mics, just looking. And eventually I went up and I did pretty good. I don't know, how'd you do your first time? I didn't kill, but it was fine.
The first time I ever went up on stage, I tanked miserably.
Really?
Because it was a dance club that they'd shut down for the night, didn't tell anybody they were shutting down, and did a talent show.
Ugh.
I'll get into that when we talk about
it. I can't wait.
Me, yeah. It's a beauty.
So I start doing open mics, and then eventually I start because I was so naive about how comedy worked. I thought that like comedy clubs were really only for like super professionals. I didn't know that they had open mic night and new talent night and things like that. So I didn't really make my way into the improv until about a year into my career. And by then, man, I was tempered in steel. Because I had been doing shows where it's just like you say, like you just walk in, it's a nightclub on ladies' night. They turn the music off and they're like, yeah, we got some comics here. And you're like, oh my God, no. It's just like I had been going up in such horrific situations that when I finally went to go do stand up at a club, I'm like, everybody's sitting down and focused on the stage. I was like, this is easy. I'm used to like doing, you know, usually guys are playing pool and playing video poker, and there's somebody making a blended drink, you know. I'm just happy, you know. So like once I kind of hit the ground running in terms of my career, once I got to the major comedy club, which was the now deceased Miami Improv.
Okay. And you know, they just opened a new Miami Improv, right?
I heard about that. Yeah.
Supposedly amazing. So you start doing stand-up. You work as an MC, a host for a little while.
I was the house MC. The house MC at the...
Which means you were there all month, all the time.
I was just almost all the time. I was anybody that came through town during a certain period of time, I probably work with them. And it was...
thrilling you.
8 o'clock here. No, you know, honestly, that allowed me to meet all the comics, and that's when certain guys started taking me on the road. And
who?
The first person to ever take me on the road was Jim Norton.
Really?
No. Dice and I. I went on tour with Dice for a couple dates. I did road dates with Dice, and then I was on tour with Jim Norton for probably 2 years. I toured with Jim Norton, and I also toured with Bill Bellamy.
Huh.
For a ton of years.
Very similar audiences.
Yeah. And again, that kind of made me become who I was, because I wasn't going to fluctuate and have an act for Jim Norton's crowd and an act for Bill Bellamy's crowd. It was like, I'm going to always be me. And I think that really helped me hone like who I am. So it's like, I want everybody to be able to laugh at me and empathize and be able to laugh with me in my experiences.
There's
something
to truth. The truth. Everybody can feel the truth, whether they can identify 100% with what you're even talking about in a given situation isn't always what's needed, but it's can they feel what you felt because of the way you're telling it?
Yeah.
I think that's important. So that's interesting that you say that you didn't change anything. Did you tell the jokes in a different way? Did you speed up, slow down either way? Did you, because I learned in like about when I went out east, I would have to just punch them more. It was like that.
Yeah.
And out west, it just slowed down and just in the south, you talk slower because that's how everybody is. It's not an intelligence thing.
No, it's not.
I was explained, and I don't know if this is right or wrong, but people told me years ago, it's so hot and humid in the South. That's just how people move. When you're trying to walk through air, and it's basically like you're walking in a pool, people just start to do that all the time, and just we'll get to it.
that makes sense, though.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just somebody trying to point something out that they believe was the logic of it, or if it's real. And maybe it's like maybe there's a combination of both. But out on the West Coast, it was like to be too cool for school. Don't act like you're telling a joke. Just talk. The alternative comedy scene in the Midwest, I always felt, was like pretty normal. Just be a person, and you could just go.
I really like Midwestern audiences.
Yeah,
they're just so polite. You just sit there. You're almost like they're almost like a house cat. They just sit there and just they're really like you know, Columbus and Cincinnati. I think I recorded my last album in Cincinnati.
Well, a lot of times they're just happy you came there. They're just happy you came. Like in LA, they expect you to be there. In New York City, they expect you to be there. You go outside of those cities and they're truly appreciative of the fact that you came there, because they will hear people say, I don't want to go. So I've been to Iowa a few times, and they actually come up to you if they see and like, thank you for coming to their state.
Yes.
Nobody from New York's like, hey, really appreciate you coming to New York. No, they're like, you're supposed to be here. You know?
That's so true.
It's just, that's even worse in Boston, where they think you want to be, they don't even think you just want to be there. They think you want to be them.
Yes. Oh, Boston.
I'm sure you've got some other. I don't even know what it is specifically. I just know generalizations.
Yeah. I had some good times up there, though.
Okay. That's good. That turns it around.
There we go.
So you're opening for some different people on the road, different audiences. You're learning from those experiences as well. People don't understand this about comedy. It's not like you just show up and start doing it. There is an evolution to your growth as a comic.
Most definitely.
And it's constantly happening. I don't know if it ever stops. So then you're on the road doing these dates with different people. What's the next thing?
Next thing is I get my half hour. I then half start
comedy special.
Yeah, half hour Comedy Central special. And from there, I just started to book things. You know, just nothing huge, but just steadily working and steadily doing stand up. You know, on the road and on television. You know, I became a writer for Shaquille O'Neal's Upload on True TV. So I wrote on that for a year.
We really appreciate everything you do.
Shaq, I missed the show, buddy.
Hey. Who are you?
And working with Shaq was awesome. So he's like such a fun dude. I was really worried. You know, I'm sure you have this where you meet somebody who you're a fan of and you're like, please don't be a douche.
Yeah, all the time.
You know, and sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. Luckily, I was just like, Shaq is a great guy. And worked with him. And then
he may be the biggest human being, not just height, but just all around size.
Well, he's just, makes sense. He's as wide as he is tall. He's the only person that you never get used to. Like every time you see him, you just kind of, you go, oh my, that's a big dude.
Yeah.
Every single time. You never get like, oh, well, I saw him yesterday. It's just, it's like 51st States. Like it's just as startling. So yeah, I worked with Shaq and then got a job hosting as a host on the BBC for a show called Officially Amazing, where I watched people break Guinness Book of World Records for 100 episodes. Like we did 100 episodes of that show. So for a long time, if there was a record broken anywhere, you know, the continental United States, I was there.
Wow.
And that's been it. Just some acting.
How did the Daily Blast happen?
The Daily Blast happened. That's so interesting. And I'm
glad you were going to skip it then.
I'm glad you brought it up. No, this goes back probably 3 years ago. I had booked a talk show that was going to go on NBC. It was going to be called The Happy Hour. And it was me, Lisa Rinna from The Real Housewives, Scott Wolf. I don't know if you know, he's an actor from Party of Five.
Mm-hmm.
And my girl, Khalees, the singer. She has that song, My Milkshake's Bringing All the Boys to the Yard. And it, that one.
Right.
You know the song?
I know what it is, yes.
Okay, there we go. You seem uncomfortable talking about
better than you.
Yeah. So it was going to be the four of us. And this show was going to go down. And I mean, it's very lucrative. It was, you know, they're telling us the brass of the show. We're going to let Days of Our Lives finish this run. And you guys are going to probably replace Days of Our Lives. So
and this is what type of show?
It's a morning talk show. It's okay. Like it was like The View, but with two guys and two girls.
Okay.
And so
that's what I thought, but I just want to make sure.
Yeah, I don't know if you can wrap your head around that concept. Yeah. So I remember one time I was out performing and my ex-wife called me and she was like, did you check your email? And I'm like, why would I do that? And I just like, she was like, check it and call me back. And I'm like, that's not good. And, you know, I opened my email and there was like, you know, to all of us, it was like, I'm sorry to report that they're going to keep Days of Our Lives on. And, you know, the show's not going to be greenlit. So I'm like, dude, I already had the money spent in my head. I mean, this show was going down, you know, and the fact that it didn't, I was like, oh, okay. So you do what you always do. You take your butt right back out on the road. And I'm on the road for a couple of years and I get a phone call from one of the old producers of that show that didn't go. And she said, we have a new concept we've been commissioned to work on called Daily Blast Live, where it's going to be live. And it's going to be male and female hosts talking about today's topic. So we thought about you because we liked what you did for Happy Hour. Can you come audition? So the audition was in Los Angeles. I went and auditioned and I got it. And we've been going a year and a half now.
Like, tell people that haven't seen the show what the show is exactly. Do a little more in depth than what you just talked about.
Well, yeah, it's a live daytime talk show. And we talk about issues And I think the thing that kind of separates us is the live aspect. You don't realize the power of that until you are on air and a tragedy has happened, you know, and you experience it almost in real time. We were on the air for the Parkland shooting, I believe. I think we were on the air for the Vegas shooting. But just like all these emotions, they kind of happen in real time. I have bawled my eyes out on live TV and laughed my butt off on live TV. It's just kind of, it's a real live interactive show. And I think people appreciate that because people can respond like right as you're talking, somebody be like, that's stupid. You're like, well, good. All right. Thanks for interacting.
They send that stuff and you get that on a computer that goes on the screen or?
It's we have iPads in front of us.
Okay.
Yeah. So that we read it. We read everything.
Really?
Everything. But yeah, so that's how I got here. It's a long winding road of Mississippi, Providence, Rhode Island, Miami Shores, Florida, Los Angeles, California, New York City, and now Denver, Colorado, where I'm looking at some beautiful mountains on a Sunday morning. What a great way to wake up, man. Well, it's the second best way to wake up.
Of course.
Frank, I had to get that one in. Come on.
Yeah. All right. Make it magical. All right. Well, anything else you want to add to that? I think
I think that's good, man.
You tired me out about you. I'm tired of you.
Enough about the black guy. Got it.
All right. Well, that's it for this one. And my interview, you'll be able to take a look at as well when Al Jackson goes in depth on Frank Caliendo.
If I don't make you cry, it's not a real interview.
I'm tearing up already.
All right.